The Divorce of Christianity from Judaism, the second talk of the 2011 Oktoberfest Conference, entitled How Jewish Was Jesus, was presented by David Crabtree on October 7, 2011. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2011. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
My topic is how did Judaism become divorced from Christianity? Obviously, from reading the New Testament, it's clear that Jesus, the apostles, were all Jewish. And in fact, they were observant Jews who took their tradition very seriously, were very comfortable being observant Jews, and yet embracing what the message that Jesus brought. So how is it, and how did it come to pass that a few centuries later, we have two very distinct religions? We have Judaism and we have Christianity. And two religions that are, to one degree or another, hostile to one another and have not a lot of exchange between them. So that's the topic that I'm addressing. When I agreed to do this topic, I didn't realize how big the topic is. As I began to look at the literature that's available, there are a lot of books that have been written on this topic, and they're very interesting. Many of them are quite recent. Most of them have been written in the last 20 years, and I'll explain why that is in a little bit. Generally speaking, though, the books that have been written up to this point are on fairly narrow aspects of the problem. That's common in history, that when a topic is opened up for discussion, or a different approach on an old topic is opened up for discussion, people jump in and they look at very specialized aspects of the problem. And it's only after a number of those works have been written that someone can come along and build on that foundation and generalize from that work that's been done. Synthesize and pull it all together. And to my knowledge, there isn't much of that synthesis that has happened on the research that's been done in the last 20 years. So what I am going to do is talk about this topic fairly generally and do a little bit of that synthesis, but it's premature. And I don't really know enough to be speaking on this authoritatively, so take it for what it's worth. I've enjoyed the reading immensely, and I'm interested in going on and reading a lot more, but to a large extent, it's just raised more questions in my mind than it has answered. So I'm just giving you an update on my thinking at this point. There is one question that really pops out at me as the interesting question here, and it's the one that I'm going to pursue tonight. And that is, one of the authors that I read made the observation, a couple of authors actually made the same observation. It is curious to note that in the second and third centuries of our era, that Christianity and Judaism both take some of the same kinds of steps to form themselves into an organized hierarchical religion. They're both doing that at about the same time and in similar ways. Is that not intriguing? And so that's the issue that I want to explore. Why would that be the case? What's going on here? And I'm helped in thinking about this by an analogy. Think about a pond with glass still water. If you throw a pebble into that pond, it's going to send out ripples of waves that are going to go out from the place where that pebble hits the water. And as they go further from that pebble, they will lose force, but they get bigger. They affect more. And so if you take now another pebble, it's going to do the same thing. It's going to send out a ripple of waves. And so where those waves hit, there's going to be a different kind of dynamic that's happening in the surface of the water. So if we take any point in that pond, and then we throw a bunch of pebbles into the pond, a whole set of waves are going to hit that point at a different force and from a different angle. Now if we mark two points in that pond and throw a bunch of pebbles in, they're all going to be affected by the same action, wave action, but they're both going to be affected differently because the waves are coming from a different angle and a different amount of force. But they're all going to be affected by those same waves, just slightly differently. The Roman Empire is like that pond. And as we throw pebbles into that, it is social, political, economic phenomena that are taking place in the Roman Empire. And Christianity and Judaism are two different points in that pond, fairly close together. In fact, early on, they're really close together. And they are going to be washed by those same waves, but slightly differently. And thinking about these Christianity and Judaism being affected by social, political, and economic forces is helpful, I think. And I hadn't really thought of it in these terms before. And that's what we're going to look at. Okay, how did this topic become interesting? Why so much interest in the last 20 years in this topic of the split between Judaism and Christianity? Prior to World War II, the dominant way of telling the story of the development of Christianity that dates way back to Eusebius, and it's followed throughout history up until about World War II, is a view of, and this is the storyline that is told primarily by Christians, it's the story of a new and vibrant religion being brought onto the scene by Jesus and the apostles, that is a significant break from that which preceded it, and it very quickly supplants a bankrupt and corrupted Judaism. And that is the storyline that has been told for a very long time. The most prominent of the proponents of that view was a German scholar by the name of Walter Bauer, who described the emergence of Christianity in those terms. But he was not the only. There were many others in the early 1900s that told a similar kind of story. But after World War II and the Holocaust and the connections that were shown between the German Christian heritage and the development of Nazism and the Holocaust, people, scholars, and in particular Jewish scholars, began to raise the question, is that storyline accurate? And does not recent history, does not the Holocaust point out that Christianity was complicit in what happened in Germany and the attempt to eradicate the Jews? And is it not the case that Christianity has the seeds of antisemitism built into it right from the start? And if that's the case, how can we tell this story of a triumphant, vibrant, shining new religion coming onto the stage and supplanting the old and corrupt? So people started attacking that storyline and questioning the bases on which it would, had been constructed. Then there was another event that was of equal importance, and that was the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. In the deserts in Palestine, by accident, some Bedouins discovered a cache of ancient documents that had been stowed away in caves as Roman soldiers were coming and sweeping through the area in an apparent attempt to save those writings. They were found, and they included a wealth of information that was not previously known to us, moderns. That there were copies of books of the Old Testament, but in addition, there were a number of writings that had been written by the sect that was inhabiting the area at Qumran, in addition to other writings that were helped us to begin to get a picture of what was happening in Jewish intellectual life at the time, at about the time of Jesus. And what was discovered is there was a rich exchange of ideas that was happening in Palestine at this time, and that there were a large number of different sects that were interacting with one another and arguing and debating various points of theology and philosophy. So all of a sudden we know a lot more about Judaism at the time of Jesus than we had ever known before. And when those two things came together, that is, questioning the old storyline and then a huge amount of additional information, people began to dive into that and sort that out. The Dead Sea Scrolls, by the way, were just went online. It was a project, it was a joint project carried out by Google and I think the Israel Museum. I think it's the entire corpus of the Dead Sea Scrolls can now be accessed online. They have digital copies of them. You can actually see the scrolls. I can't read them, but I can see them. So that's pretty amazing. And the Dead Sea Scrolls were only made public, I don't remember, it was only like 10 years ago that they were made public. What happens in scholarship is if there's a new discovery like that, you want to keep it to yourself till you can publish books about it before it is made available to a wider group of scholars, and that's the trick that happened with the Dead Sea Scrolls until they were kind of pried out of the scholars' hands and made public. So, as a result, in the last 20 years, there are a whole bunch of books that have been written. And what's interesting is these are books written by Christian scholars, oftentimes Christian scholars, occasionally non-Christian scholars, that is, non-believers in anything, atheists, but as well as Jewish scholars, and all sorting out different issues of this problem. And the discussion is, in my mind, a very rich discussion. It's very interesting. And I am pleased with the amount of mutual respect that has been shown it's truer in the last 15 years than it was earlier, but a lot of mutual respect between the different parties. Okay, let me chart out, just give you a few of the features of Judaism at the time of Christ. I'm going to give you seven features of Judaism at the time of Christ, and hopefully kind of paint a little bit of a picture of what was going on then and what they were thinking. The first thing that I want to note is that Judaism at the time of Christ was very different from the Old Testament religion as depicted in the Old Testament. And the reason for that is that the history, the time that had passed between the end of the composition of the Old Testament and the time of Jesus. A lot of history went by. And I'm not just talking about time, I'm talking about important events. In the Old Testament, the prophets are constantly harping on the fact that the Jews were constantly turning away to idolatry, to paganism, being won over to the pagan religions of the surrounding peoples. They were assimilating the culture of their neighbors, including the religion. When the Babylonians conquered Judea and took the Jews into exile into Babylonia, and then they come back from Babylon, there is a sea change that happens in Jewish culture. There is a sense in which Jews got religion. Because when Jesus and the apostles come along, that is the theme of the prophets is not a theme of theirs. Jesus and the apostles are not attacking the idolatry and the cultural assimilation of the neighboring pagan cultures by the Jews. That's not their theme. Their theme is a different theme. And that's because the Jews had got religion. By the time of Jesus, it has become a cultural taken for granted that Jews follow the law. That the law is very important. You have to follow it, and you have to follow it rightly. That's an important feature to keep in mind. The second, Jews were not focused on orthodoxy as much as orthopraxy. That is to say, they were more interested in right practice than they were in right doctrine or right theology. Now, that's not to say that they were not interested in theology whatsoever. There is interest in theology in Judaism at the time, but there is much more interest in the right practice of religion. That is to say, what does the law require of us? How do we comply with that law? As a result, then, it was Jews of that time that developed the practice of building a hedge around the law, and many of you have probably heard of that. That is, you make the law even more strict so that there is less chance that you will violate the law. If the law says that you don't walk a certain distance on the Sabbath, then you don't walk, you keep the distance shorter than that, etc. It's that kind of thing. So building a hedge around the law in order to maintain orthopraxy, right practice. The third feature, there was no centralized religious authority. There was no body, there was no place you could go in Judaism to resolve theological disputes and differences, to rule on that kind of thing. Now, the Sanhedrin is a little bit mysterious. We don't know exactly what it did, but it didn't resolve theological disputes. It wasn't that kind of body. There was no such kind of body. There was no arbiter of theological controversy. There were no declarations of heresy that occurred in Judaism during the time of Christ. And we'll come back to that. The fourth feature, I've mentioned this before, this was a discovery from the Dead Sea Scrolls. There were a wide variety of sects that were active at the time of Christ. We've known for a long time from Josephus that there were the three main, what he likens them to philosophical schools, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Essenes. But what the Dead Sea Scrolls make clear is that that is a gross generalization, because there are many sects that are active that occupy positions in between those different philosophical schools. And the lines between those sects were ill-defined. It's hard to say where the Essenes stop and the Pharisees start. They're not clearly defined. And there were sharp differences that were expressed between these different sects. Sometimes it would even come to blows. Sometimes there was fighting in the streets. But they were interacting with one another, and they considered one another Jews. They just disagreed with them. The fifth feature, Judaism was a temple-based religion. Jews, no matter where they lived, whether they lived in Palestine or whether they lived in the diaspora throughout the Roman Empire or beyond, the temple was the center of the Jewish religion. Now, there are some minor exceptions here. The Samaritans, they had a different place where they worshipped. There was also a temple that was built in Egypt. A copy of the temple in Jerusalem was built in Egypt, where a number of Jews that were living there worshipped at. But by and large, for 90-some percent of the Jews, the temple in Jerusalem is the center of the Jewish religion. And Jews from the diaspora, it was expected that a Jew living outside of Palestine would make a trip to Jerusalem at least once in their life to celebrate the holidays. Sixth, Judaism by this time, by the time of Christ, had developed the system of synagogues. We don't know when those started. It is thought that they probably started in Babylon, when the Jews were in exile in Babylon, but it is not clear. We don't know for sure where the synagogues first came into being. But the synagogue seems to have been a development of Jewish culture that made it possible for them to maintain their Jewishness and encourage one another in their Jewishness while being away from the temple. So when Jews were outside of Palestine, and then there was any number of them at all in an area, they would build a synagogue, and that synagogue would become kind of a cultural center for Jews. But the main activities in the synagogue were to read the Torah, to interpret the Torah, and to pray. And then there were other activities that took place in the synagogues, and those varied from one synagogue to another. But those three things were common to all the synagogues. And they spread throughout the diaspora. And by the time of Christ, there are synagogues in Palestine, and there are even synagogues in Jerusalem. So they've even come back. They have become such a part of Jewish culture that they come back to the place where even the temple is to serve that function of helping keep Jewish identity and culture alive. And the seventh feature I want to point out is that the Jews had a kind of privileged status in the Roman Empire. I say kind of, and I'll have to explain what I mean by kind of. The Jewish religion was recognized as having a unique status in Roman society, that Judaism was a recognized religion, and Jews were not required to worship the emperor. That is a concession that the Jews won by a variety of means. The first of all is, from very early on, Jews had been supportive of Roman power coming into the Near East. And the Jews played a key role in helping Caesar, Julius Caesar, during the civil wars, helped him be victorious in that civil war. And he remembered that, and his heirs remembered that. Also, a number of prominent Jews befriended a number of prominent Roman officials, high-ranking officials, and they remembered that as well. Thirdly, the Jews had been particularly hard to subdue and conquer. When the Romans tried to force them to worship the emperor, there was so much resistance that that the Romans eventually acquiesced. The compromise that was reached is that Jews would not have to worship the emperor as long as in the temple in Jerusalem prayers were given on behalf of the emperor. And that was the solution to the problem. So Jews had a kind of privileged status in Roman Empire. They didn't have to worship the emperor. They had quite a bit of access to the people in power in Rome, and gained a number of privileges as a result of that. Furthermore, throughout the Roman Empire, Jews were recognized as holding to a very high moral standard. And that was extremely attractive to a significant portion of the Roman population at a time when morality in general was in decay. So Romans in Roman culture are looking at the decay, the moral decay of their society, and they see Jewish culture and the standards that they are abiding by, upholding, and they're attracted to that. It looks refreshingly wholesome. As a result, a significant number of people throughout the Roman Empire, Gentiles, non-Jews, begin attending synagogues on a regular basis where they hear the Torah read and where they hear the Torah interpreted. And they become extremely knowledgeable about Judaism and Jewish culture. And those people become known as the God-fearers, and we'll come back and talk about those in a little bit later. But that is a significant phenomenon. There are quite a few people that fit into that category. Apparently, there were not a lot of them that converted to Judaism. They didn't go through the official steps to convert to Judaism, but they continued to attend the synagogue and become more knowledgeable about Judaism. Interestingly, during this period of time, Jews don't seem to have carried out missionary activity. They didn't seem to go out of their way to gain converts, but they didn't discourage it. People, the God-fearers, the Gentiles who had come to the synagogue were very welcome and made to feel a part of the community, and that added to the numbers. Okay, now I said they kind of enjoyed a privileged status. There is another part to it, and that is there was quite a bit of anti-Semitism in the Roman Empire. That when you look at the rank and file in Roman culture, generally speaking, people did not think highly of Jews. Judaism, the Jewish religion, many of its practices were thought to be disgusting and abhorrent. So there's quite a bit of anti-Semitism at the popular level. Okay, let me go through the history of the church, just talk about how the church evolved. This is very brief. You guys probably know much of this. Talk about the development of the church over the first four centuries. And then I'm going to do the same thing with Judaism. As you know, after Jesus died and then was resurrected, the apostles kind of congregated in Jerusalem, stayed there for a period of time. And they began to go out into the streets of Jerusalem and take opportunities to preach the gospel that Jesus had brought. And that resulted in some tensions early on, as it's described in Acts, but this is discussed by the Jewish authorities, and the Jewish authorities decide we won't mess with them. If this is not from God, it'll die out. If it's from God and we try to fight it, then it would be to our detriment. So let's just leave it alone. And there seems to have been that kind of laissez-faire perspective for the first short period of time. But the first incident that develops is with Stephen. Stephen is preaching in Jerusalem, and he arouses opposition from a group of Jews. And in Acts chapter 6, it describes who these Jews are. And it says that they are from the synagogue of the freedmen and from, and I can't remember, Cyprus, Egypt, something else. It's interesting that it tells us that these are Jews from this particular synagogue. One thing that's interesting is we have a synagogue in Jerusalem at the time of the apostles. But the people that are in this synagogue are from the diaspora. Now, it has been hypothesized that this synagogue of the freedmen refers to a group of Jews that were taken captive when the Romans first came and conquered Palestine. And I can't remember the date. I think it's like 65 BC, something like that. The Romans come in, and they, for the most part, Jews are welcome them coming, but there is some opposition. Some Jews are taken captive, and they are taken back to Rome as slaves. But then we know from Tacitus that those particular Jews were released after a short period of time. And it is thought that this synagogue might be a synagogue that was built by some of those returning Jewish slaves. There is a synagogue that's been found that dates back to this time. It's right near the Temple Mount, and a plaque has been found that has the name of the family that built the synagogue, and the name is Latinized. And it says that his father and his father's father were keepers of a synagogue, and the names are Latinized. So they suspect that that's probably the synagogue that's being referred to in Acts 6. In any case, what's interesting about this opposition is the fiercest opposition to Stephen's message is coming from Jews who have been abroad and are now in Jerusalem, which suggests that she's running into the most nationalistic element in Jewish society in Jerusalem. And their complaint with respect to Stephen, he's bad-mouthing the law, or in another place it says Moses, and the temple. Those are what they accuse Stephen of doing. Stephen then is stoned to death. After he is stoned to death, some of the Jewish believers go out from Jerusalem into other cities in Judea and even beyond. Eventually, Christianity then reaches Antioch, and that's where we have the first mention of the term Christians is in Antioch. Paul, who had been opposed to Christianity, in fact, he was present when Stephen was killed and was approving of it. He is converted, and he becomes a missionary then for Christianity. And he goes to synagogues. That's his pattern. He goes to a synagogue in any location, and he preaches the gospel. But what he quickly discovers is the most ready audience is this population of God-fearers, Gentiles who have been highly Judaized. They have been acculturated in Judaism, and they are particularly receptive to the gospel. One of the things that's interesting about that is the God-fearers have the information that helps them to make sense of the gospel, but they don't have as much of that nationalism that would make them defensive of the old-time religion. So Paul's going out and is spreading the gospel and is attracting more and more Gentiles, and the question then arises, well, what is a Gentile Christian? How do we think about a Gentile who responds to the gospel? And in Acts 15, there's the meeting, the council that's held in Jerusalem that's going to resolve that question. Do Gentiles have to become Jews in order to become believers, to become Christians? So now we've got that first time that this question has really been raised. What distinguishes Christianity from Judaism? Are they different? Are they the same? How so? So starting to work on that definition. And what the council concludes is that no, you don't have to become a Jew in order to be accepted as a Christian, but you have to be respectful of the sensibilities of Jews, and that is laid out. Now, it's interesting that in order to resolve this dispute, they turn to Jerusalem. So early on, Jerusalem is seen to be the center of Christianity. But in 70 AD, the Romans come in and they destroy the temple in Jerusalem and they drive all of the Jews out of the city. This is brought on by a rebellion that's staged by the Zealots. And the Romans, a Roman army in the area decides we are going to resolve this problem of a series of rebellions within Jerusalem. We are going to solve it once and for all, and they come in with great force and destroy the temple. Christians who were in Jewish believers that were in Jerusalem fled from Jerusalem in anticipation of this, many of them going to Petra. So this kind of spreads out the Jewish believers into a much wider area than they had been before. And they take that message with them where they go. And where they go then, they gain more and more converts. And as they go out from Jerusalem, as they go out from Israel and Palestine, the proportion of people converting to Christianity that are from a Gentile background increases. But after the destruction of Jerusalem then, Christianity has no center, no geographical center. There's no place to which they look as the center of Christianity. As Christianity spreads then, they come in, Christians begin to interact more and more with pagans and with Gnostics, Gnosticism being a kind of composite mystery religion that it has all kinds of different varieties that became popular in the Near East at this time. And that starts raising the question, what distinguishes Christianity from paganism? What distinguishes Christianity from Gnosticism? So now Christianity has to go through another series of questions of self-definition. What is Christianity at its essence? And part of that question then is what's authoritative with respect to Christianity? It's the Bible, but what does the Bible consist of? What does the Old Testament consist of? What does the New Testament consist of? All of those questions have to be discussed and have to be resolved. As Christianity then spreads into these more Gentile areas, we start having a much larger influx of people into the Christian religion, become members of Christianity, who have no Jewish background whatsoever. Their background is paganism, or their background is Gnosticism. And that's going to change the flavor of Christianity. It's going to change the way that churches operate. It changes the way they think about things. It changes the way they interpret the Bible. They don't have the same background. They don't have the same approach to literature and the way that it's written and interpreted. As Christianity grows, then it becomes a bit of a concern to the Roman government. It becomes enough of a force that it is on the radar screen of the Caesar. And we start to have persecution of Christianity conducted by the Caesars, the most violent of which comes under Diocletian, who, after 60 years of civil war in Rome, is trying to pull Rome back together, and it's a difficult thing to do at this time. Rome is, from about the mid-200s on, Rome is beginning to kind of fly into a gazillion pieces. It takes a long time for that to happen, but it's beginning in that process. And the 60 years of civil war didn't help in that respect. So now Diocletian comes along, and he needs to pull this thing all together. How is he going to pull it all together? And there he tries to arouse respect for especially him and his authority by taking on the trappings of the king as that was practiced in the East, in Persia, that lots of wealth, lots of pomp and circumstance, all of that helps elevate you in the eyes of your subjects and makes you more special and legitimizes your rule. And he tried to do that. And that was especially important to him, having come from a family of slaves. He had risen all the way up to a general and then Caesar, despite having that kind of background. He had a big ceremony that he was going to celebrate in Antioch. And as a part of this ceremony, they would cut up animals and read the auspices. That was general, commonly done practice in Roman culture. And all of the auspices were bad. And so he asked the priests, what happened? Why are all the auspices bad? And they said, we saw some Christians crossing themselves while we did the ceremony. And so he began a long series of persecution of Christians, trying to get them to convert back to paganism or die. So persecution was carried out throughout the Roman Empire. It was enforced irregularly. Some places it was strictly enforced, some places less. Some places Christians had to make sacrifices to the traditional gods. Other places all they had to do was hand over a Christian hymnal or something like that. So it was very uneven. But there were a number of Christians that died. Many Christians died. Many were suffered a lot of persecution, torture. Interestingly, during this period, any Jewish Christians were exempt, because they were considered Jews and they didn't have to worship the emperor. Then after Diocletian, there's another civil war. The emperor that emerges victorious out of that is Constantine, and Constantine establishes Christianity as the state religion. So he decides, rather than eradicate Christianity, he's going to embrace it, and Christianity, he thinks, has the unique potential of actually being a unifying force in the Roman Empire. This is his chance, because Christianity is transnational, trans-ethnic. So now, having been made the state religion, now there are many benefits to be gained by being Christian. Whereas just a few years earlier, you could die for it. Now there's much to be gained from it. And so the number of Christians increases dramatically, and the kinds of people that are becoming Christians now have had no significant knowledge, previous knowledge of Jewish culture and Jewish literature. So Constantine then embraces Christianity as this unifying force. However, there's this problem, and that is Christianity isn't unified. There are sharp theological disputes that are taking place between different groups of Christians, in particular with respect to who is Jesus in relationship to God. And so to resolve that issue in 325, Constantine calls together leaders of the church from all over the empire to a council at Nicaea to hammer out these issues. And so now, for the first time, we have a body brought together that is going to make the determination what is orthodox and what is heretical. And it is at Constantine's prodding that this happens. It's important for him that this happen for political reasons. Constantine pushed for a resolution on this, and a resolution was reached. The Nicene Creed was drafted and was adopted. But the controversy continued afterwards. Constantine had counted on that being pulling everybody together. It didn't happen. The same debate went on for another 50 or 60 years and continued to be a divisive force in the empire. I'll just point out that at about this time then, a movement arose in northern Africa, the Donatist movement, which was a legacy of the persecutions. The question that people were beginning to raise was, who is qualified to be a priest? Who is qualified to be a leader of the church? Because during the persecutions, some leaders, some priests, had been willing to hand over hymnals or even Bibles to the Romans as a sign, as a way of saying, we're cooperative. And some believers who died for their, or were tormented for their belief, or tortured, or others were, did die. But Christians are looking at those who suffered the ultimate penalty and saying, if they suffered the ultimate penalty, but these others capitulated, what qualifies these others to be leaders in the church? And the Donatist movement said, you have to be pure in order to be an official in the church. And that was another very divisive issue that came up. And eventually, the Roman emperor used force to put down the Donatists. Augustine actually argued that force was legitimate in putting down that kind of rebellion. So we have political force being used to suppress heresy. Okay, let's look at the early history of rabbinical Judaism. Rabbinical Judaism, as we know it, that is, rabbinical Judaism that accepts oral law and the Talmud as being authoritative, equally authoritative with the Bible, that doesn't come into being until at least the 3rd century and maybe the 4th or 5th century of our era, AD. How did that come to be? After the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, just as the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem had a big impact on Christianity, it had an even bigger impact on Judaism. Judaism, as I pointed out, is a temple-based religion. How do you do Judaism without a temple? And initially, that was a very difficult question. It had lost its center. There was a Pharisee, a rabbi by the name of Yohanan ben Zakkai, who opposed the rebellion that the Romans came to put down in 70 AD. He was in Jerusalem. He opposed the rebellion. He actually sided with the Romans. But when the Romans placed Jerusalem under siege, he was unable to leave. They wouldn't let him out. So this is according to legend. He had his followers put him in a coffin and say to the authorities in Jerusalem, "We got to get him out and bury him before nightfall as the law requires." And so they were allowed to leave. And after he gets out, they open up the coffin and he pops out. And he goes and goes to the Roman officer, the Roman general, who is Titus, the son of the Roman Caesar. And he had befriended the Roman emperor earlier. And when he leaves Jerusalem and goes to the Romans, he asks two things of the Romans. He asks that he be allowed to settle in Javna, in Palestine, and that he be allowed to set up a school. And both of those are granted. So he sets up the first rabbinical school in Javna. And the main project of this school then is to kind of think through what is Judaism without the temple. And they begin to work towards developing that thing. Now, when I say that, we have very little record of exactly what they did. And so this is kind of a hypothetical reconstruction. But we do know that in Javna, at about 90 AD, the school there, the community of scholars, banned the use of the Septuagint in the synagogues. The Septuagint was a Greek translation of the Old Testament. It was required that they use the Hebrew rather than the Greek translation. We also know that at Javna, they proclaimed an anathema on Jewish Christians. In other words, to be a Jewish Christian was to be a heretic in Jewish eyes. And it is speculated that it was at this time that they determined which of the books of the Old Testament were in the canon, were authoritative, were inspired. And it was at this time that they decided that the Apocrypha was not authoritative. Then the synagogues become the center of Jewish culture and religion. The synagogues scattered throughout the Roman Empire, heavily influenced by decisions that are made in Javna and to one degree or another imposed by the academy, the scholars in Javna, through the Pharisees. The synagogues begin to more or less answer to the scholars in Javna. And over time, a rabbinical system develops that's more hierarchical and more organized than it has ever been before. Previously, to be a rabbi, you just had to be appointed. A rabbi would appoint his successor. And that's all that had to happen. Now that begins to change. Approval has to be received from a Jewish court initially, and then later approval has to be received from the president of the court. So a system develops in which becoming a rabbi is more officially regulated than it has ever been before. Okay. Is that not curious? Is that not interesting? We have Christianity and Judaism both becoming more organized, becoming hierarchical even, for the first time begin to make decisions of what is heresy and what is orthodoxy, and using political power, using their the power of their organization to enforce those decisions. Why is that happening? There are several reasons for that, I think. I'm just going to give three or four. The first is they are interacting with one another. And I think that the decisions of one is having an impact on the other. The most obvious one is when the Jews proclaim an anathema on Jewish Christians, it's after that then that Christians proclaim an anathema on Judaizers and Jews. So they're interacting with one another. I remember in one of my classes in history, one of my professors was explaining that whenever you've got a frontier line between the battle line, that you think in terms of them being very separate culturally, and they hate each other, so they aren't going to adopt the culture of the other. But the reality is, a battle line is a place where there is a lot of cultural exchange. They're fighting against each other, and as a result of that, they're getting to know one another, and there's a significant amount of cultural exchange that happens across that line. Just one simple example, the American frontier. You have the whites fighting against the Indians. Well, it isn't very long before you have the whites wearing Indian clothes and using Indian tactics. And vice versa, you start having Indians using the weapons of the whites, etc. There's a lot of cultural exchange that happens over a battle line. Similarly, I think there was a lot of cultural exchange that happened over this dispute between Judaism and Christianity. Even though they're opposing one another, they're learning a lot from one another and doing some similar things. And they're both trying to define themselves anew. Judaism has to define itself after the destruction of the temple. Christianity has to define itself vis-a-vis Judaism and vis-a-vis paganism. So they're both doing much the same thing in the same cultural environment, and there's a lot of exchange between the two. The second, they're both responding to some of the same developments in the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire at this time is very troubled. I mentioned before, it's kind of disintegrating on the inside. It's also being attacked from the outside. It's being greatly threatened from the outside, more than it's ever been in the past. And with this, with the foreign invasions and the troubles, their economic troubles that they're having inside, there's a lot of social unrest. As a result, it's hard for the Roman authorities to keep a lid on everything, keep it all together. What is the Roman response to that? Use more force. They try to make the centralized power stronger and more capable of suppressing dissent. They've also got to, they need to bolster the economy because force costs money. You have to raise more money. They begin to control the economy to a greater extent than they had ever done before, imitating what had been done by the Ptolemies in Egypt, controlling prices, telling people where they can work and where they can't work, etc. So the government is trying to pull all this stuff together and using force to do it. And these religious structures begin to emulate that. They too feel all of the unrest. They're trying to hold their troops together, unify them, and they copy the pattern of the imperial government. They become more authoritarian, more hierarchical. The other thing that's happening is Christianity and Judaism are both trying to become organized religions. One of the authors that I read, he's an Orthodox Jew, Boyarin. He argues that Christianity was the first religion as we think of it. And what he means by a religion, and he's not the only one who argues this, but what he means by a religion is a set of beliefs and practices that is embraced voluntarily by someone, that someone chooses that to embrace that set of beliefs and practices. Prior to that, religion you was something you were born into predominantly. If you were Roman, the Roman gods were your gods. Well, Christianity is becoming a religion. It's a set of practices and beliefs that everybody that's a member of it chooses to embrace, regardless of their ethnic background. And they're running into a lot of competition. How do you establish yourself? How do you compete in this environment now where people can actually choose what religion they are going to embrace? Furthermore, who's going to get the state recognition and all the goodies that come from that? Christianity was the state religion with Constantine. They want to retain that monopoly after that time. And there are the problems of self-definition. So Christianity is experiencing all of these things as it tries to become a religion. Judaism is trying to imitate that and become a religion for the first time in this kind of sense. They too are sensing the competition. They too want to maintain their a kind of privileged status in the Roman Empire. And they too are having problems of self-definition. So what do? They both do the same thing. You organize, create a hierarchical structure that's patterned after the Roman government. You draw boundaries between orthodoxy and heresy. And you call in, you use political force as you can to enforce those lines. And you maintain order within your ranks. I read an interesting book by a fellow who was looking at discourse and political power late antiquity. And he did a study of debate within he starts out his book with debate within the pagan community, in the philosophers. And he points out that it went through an evolution. Originally, when we're back in very early on, so we're talking about even before Christ, there would be debates staged between philosophers. And these would be public debates, and people were invited to come and hear them. Typically, it was debates between different philosophical schools, and each side would state their case, reasoning as powerfully as they can against the other, and they would rebut one another. And when they had each said their piece, the debate was over, and people went home. And it was the audience was left to decide who they agreed with. As time went on, that was replaced by it's not the best debater, but it is the teacher with the most prestige for being knowledgeable and competent. So we have teachers that carry their own authority with them that starts to emerge. And you have schools of people that learn from them. As time goes on, that changes a little bit more, and it becomes not a teacher who is competent intellectually, but a teacher who has some competence intellectually, but it also has the right kind of character. It has to be someone who can rise above the difficulties of life. It's someone who has that kind of that peace, that the it's apatheia. You don't feel anything, and so you can just go through life unaffected by troubles. Then that evolves a little bit further into someone who can do wondrous things, someone who can demonstrate that they have some direct contact with the divine, becomes the most powerful of the philosophic leaders. And it ends up then in it is certain mystics and certain individuals who go out and live a kind of monastic lifestyle that become the most authoritative. That's happening within philosophy. And what he argues is a similar pattern is followed in Christianity. That early on in Christianity, it is the dialogue is an attempt to be persuasive. But as time goes on, people begin to rely on other things to be compelling and authoritative, and eventually it develops into a kind of mysticism by the time we get into the 4th and 5th century. Well, that is a way of maintaining order in the ranks, is by these leaders establishing their authority such that people will fall in line, and persuasion becomes less and less significant because it doesn't work well enough. And there are other things that are employed. As a result of this, then, Christianity and Judaism begin to mirror the Roman government to one degree or another. What Boyarin argues, though, is over time, Judaism pulls back from that. Judaism can't quite become a religion to the extent that Christianity became a religion. It goes a ways down that road, but as we get into the Middle Ages, it starts to pull back from that and decides it cannot go that way. And we have then the proliferation within Judaism of a bunch of sects that are all accepted as being Jewish. They draw back from making those lines between what is orthodox and what is heretical. And that is an issue that Judaism has always struggled with, partly because Judaism has always had this component of being by blood. You are Jewish by blood, not just by belief. And they've always wrestled between those two things. What makes one Jew? Is it their birth or is it their belief, their practice? And they have struggled between those two. Even the modern Israeli government struggles between those two. How do you define what is a Jew? So Boyarin says Judaism pulled back from that and decided not to continue to pursue the route of becoming a religion, whereas Christianity pursued that route. All of that is to say how this divide happened. This divide happens because the two decide that they want to become religions, separate religions. Why did they decide to separate? That's a more interesting question. That's a complex question, and therefore one I will deftly avoid. But I will just point out a couple of things. If we look back at the historical record, why is it Christians wanted to separate from Judaism? And why? What are the reasons that are given? First of all, Judaism is ethnic. Secondly, Judaism was repugnant. That generally speaking, Christians in the ancient world, after we get to the 3rd and 4th and 5th centuries, they saw Judaism as repugnant and they wanted to have no part of it. So they wanted that separation to occur. Jews likewise wanted to be separate from Christians. They could not accept a Jesus who was the Messiah. And the two reasons that are given very consistently in ancient times as well as modern times is, one, Jesus was the wrong kind of person to be a Messiah. He didn't fit the requirements, and on top of that, he was a failure. That's the first. The second is, Jesus was an arrogant lawbreaker. He didn't have respect for the law of Moses. How could he be the Messiah if he didn't have respect for the law of Moses? Then more recently, the common reason that you hear for why Jews are separate from Christianity is because Jews have suffered so much at the hands of Christians. And in fact, I suspect that last one is probably the dominant reason that Jews would give. If we are to point out a time when the breach was irrevocable, most people say that happened at the Council of Nicaea, because it was at the Council of Nicaea that Jesus was declared God, and that was also repulsive to Jews. It's part of that arrogance that I put in earlier. Okay, that's all I had to say. I hope that's helpful. I really enjoyed reading this. The stuff that I read for preparing for this, it's a fascinating topic, and there's lots to read about it. Thanks.